Nelson Mandela says, sports has the power to change the world. It has the power to inspire, the power to unite people in a way that little else does. It speaks to the youth in a language they understand. Sports can create hope where there was once only despair. It is more powerful than governments in breaking down racial barriers. It laughs in the face of all types of discrimination. I'm Chris Webber. Join me every Tuesday on my podcast, Fearless or Insane, where we'll discuss athletes, sport, and their impact in culture, politics, and society. Download on Podcast One, PodcastOne.com, and iTunes.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
Listen, all of you brothers, don't try to hold me down. I've never been one to ridicule or even raise my voice up too loud. Don't you keep saying what I can't do. Why don't you in the main? Yeah, just take the time, get your thing together.
I want to thank you for joining me today. My name is Chris Webber, and you're listening to Fearless or Insane. I really have a good time on this podcast. Thank you. I do not take your time nor your ears for granted. Hopefully we can have some fun and some good discussion, some good dialogue. I hope you're having a good holidays, or at least start to your holidays. I hope that you've had a chance to get some good food, be around some good people, get some good love, some good energy, rejuvenate a little bit. I know I've had a great start to the holidays. I was able to go home and surprise my father for his birthday. Now, any of you out there with a big family know two things. It's hard to, one, it's hard to keep secrets, and number two, it's even harder to surprise somebody in the family, and we were able to do that. So my three brothers, my sister, mother, aunties, uncles, nieces and nephews, wives, we all did a great job in keeping our mouths shut so my pops would not know what was going on. And so we had a great time, and I want to make sure the kids, they get a shout out, because the 5- to 7-year-old, I really thought they were going to be the weak link. I thought that they were going to, you know, spill the beans. You know, kids cannot hold water. If you want to know what's going on in somebody's family, all you got to do is go talk to the kids, and usually they'll spill the beans, as I said, but they did not do that. And so, you know, I definitely had a great start. I'm very thankful for my father and all that he's done and shown me. And that's just my man, 100 grand, and so it was great to finally get one over on him and surprise him. And so I hope you guys are enjoying the holidays as much as I am, and hopefully it continues for us. And in helping it continue, that good feel of the holidays, you know, and when you think of the holidays, you think of goodwill toward men, you think of forgiveness, you think of hope, you think of inspiration, you think of possibilities, you think of miracles, you think of second chances, you think of love and peace. And kind of to keep on that theme, I'd like to kind of read a quote by Nelson Mandela. And I think this quote really embodies those themes of hope, of despair, inspiration. But I was humbled when I read this quote, because a man like Nelson Mandela, who spent his whole life as a protest, he spent his life bringing people together. He spent his life as kind of a sacrifice for others, to see the plight of the common man. It was just amazing that someone who sacrificed so much could speak to the power of sport and how that could break down barriers, when his life was dedicated to breaking down those barriers. The quote goes, "Sport has the power to change the world. It has the power to inspire. It has the power to unite people in a way that little else does. It speaks to the youth in a language they understand. Sport can create hope where there was once only despair. It is more powerful than government in breaking down racial barriers. It laughs in the face of all types of discrimination." Nelson Mandela. Now, today's guest, we're speaking with a man that can, I think he can attest to the depths of despair in this country, but also he can speak to sports and how, and that's combined with hope, can challenge any system in this country. Reverend Earl Smith is the death row chaplain. He is the chaplain on death row at San Quentin State Prison. He has been so for over 27 years. But I think also what is unique about him is that, again, the depths of his clientele, or I should say the range of his clientele, because he is also chaplain for the Golden State Warriors. He is also chaplain for the San Francisco 49ers, and he was chaplain for the San Francisco Giants for over 10 years. He just released a book. It's called Death Row Chaplain. It's a no-holds-barred chronicle of his time at San Quentin State Prison. When he was hired there, he was hired at the youngest ever at his position. And we're going to talk about culture, specifically baseball, chess, dominoes. He's worked with everybody. I want to also talk to him about how white Aryans, the Mexican Mafia, the Black Guerrilla Family, Crips, Bloods, how they all had to adhere to the rule of sport, how sport helped change a culture there in prison, and how it brought some of the most likely, or some of the most unlikely, I should say, some of the most unlikely characters together in one of the toughest places to exist in this world. We're going to hear his incredible story about growing up in the Bay Area. Actually, his uncle was a relief pitcher for Satchel Paige, so sports and baseball was in his blood. But we're also going to hear about his teenage years and his time as a drug dealer, and how he was shot 6 times, and how he heard a voice on his deathbed in the hospital saying that he was going to be a chaplain in a prison. We're going to talk to him about life choices, and do prisoners deserve recreation? Do they deserve sport after some of the heinous crimes that they commit? We're also going to ask, what is forgiveness? Does everyone deserve forgiveness? He also has some incredible stories about working with inmates on death row. Their last minutes here on this earth were spent with him, their last thoughts. Just some incredible stories of sports, of perseverance, of changing the system, of forgiveness. And hope you'll join me right now, and we'll welcome our guest, Reverend Earl Smith, author of Death Row Chaplain. How you doing, Reverend Earl? Thank you for being here today.
I'm doing well, Chris. Thank you for having me on the show. I'm really excited about what I see you doing, man. It's really a blessing to me to see what God's doing with your life, man. So I'm excited that I can have this conversation with you.
No, thank you. And I really want to talk about this book, and I kind of want to also talk about your impact on athletes. And so let's just, first of all, if you could relay, you relayed a story to me, I believe it was Game 7 last year, about our first time meeting. And if you could relay that story to our listeners right now.
Yeah, I was basically reminding you of how we sort of met. When you came into the Warriors as a rookie, you told me that you were younger than everyone and you probably couldn't do what they were getting ready to go do. And what you wanted was some studies that you could have on the road while you guys were taking this East Coast trip. And I said, yeah, sure, okay. And you came back a second time and asked me, did I have them? So I went and wrote them up and gave them to you. And the thing that amazed me most was when you came back, you had completed them. And telling that story to my wife, we think that we saw something in you at that point that was more than just a kid coming out of college that was going to be a basketball player out of Michigan, but you were actually someone that was trying to figure things out and how to navigate through this thing called the NBA. And you were going to make that a big part of how you navigated. And so it was a blessing for us that you wanted to do that and then watch you do it.
Well, you know, I want to thank you. And so to our listeners out there, Reverend, what I try to do is show how athletes, how sport kind of intertwines and impacts society, culture, but also to give them an inside look. And so I was 20 years old, the youngest player to enter the league since Magic Johnson in 1979, which was years earlier before I came out in 93. And I was really scared. You know, I'd heard all these stories about what money does to people. I seen so many friends make it, not make it. I'd had so many friends be murdered before I got to the NBA. So, you know, I did not know. I had a relationship with God. I had a relationship with my family and parents. So I had a strong system, a strong village around me. But at the same time, I did not know what to go through. And so I did not know what I was going to grow through. And I wanted to stick to some of the principles that I grew up with. You know, and for those of you out there listening, I was so amazed at the people that came to chapel. Just off the top of my head, I remember David Robinson being at chapel. I remember some of the greatest players before the game. I guess I should explain that. Before the game, chapel is about a 10 to 15 minute session in which we get time with someone like Reverend Earl Smith, and he goes over life lessons with us. Very rarely do we ever talk about sport. We talk about the principles of faith, the principles of perseverance. And it's great as a player to clear your mind before that game, to clear your mind before 20,000, 50,000, 100,000 people start yelling at you and screaming at you. And so the importance of the chaplain, the chaplain's role in the NBA, in other areas of sport is very important. And that's what I want to share with you, the listener, how important it is to some athletes, though some athletes choose maybe not to share their faith, others maybe choose to share it much more than you'd like. But believe me, it is a part of life for some of the greatest athletes out there. And Reverend, before we get into your book, I'd like to just, if you could give us a little insight. Last year, I saw you in Oakland on Game 7. Of the NBA Finals, Cleveland Cavaliers versus your Golden State Warriors. Golden State was up 3-1 in that series, and I was fortunate enough to be in there with to be in the locker room before the game with Marv getting our makeup done. We usually get to be where the chaplain service is. Could you just talk to our fans a little bit about the process of chapel? What do you do in chapel, and what was your message that night?
Sure. Chapel basketball is the only sport where you have players from both teams coming. Believe that the night that you were there for that game seven, we were talking about faith for a time such as this. And we, maybe that wasn't the subject, but I think that's what I was talking about.
Yeah.
And what basically it has to be outside of yourself. It can't be fact. It has to be faith. It has to be something that's bigger than you, that you believe in, that you can grasp, that you can trust, that takes you beyond yourself. And in sport, when you're the chaplain in sport, I don't know anything about basketball. I don't even like basketball. So talking to some guy about basketball in chapel would be insane. I love the Word of God, and when guys come to chapel, it's not for a conversation about basketball from a chaplain that can't play. They're looking for something else, so we share the Word, and, you know, and basketball is so great because you get players from both teams. They sit next to each other. They share. If there's not enough programs, they give one to the guy that comes late, and they're getting ready to go. They're getting ready to go do this thing that's so intense. Game seven, And yet here they are, and for 15 minutes, the thing that they're focused on is their faith. The thing that they're focused on is not the game, but can I find peace before this game? Football, you do chapel like the night before the game or the morning early of a game, and you get the players together. And again, it's a situation where you're just sharing something. You know, in football, I think it's great because I try to listen to different words players or coaches are saying throughout the week, and I try to shape my message around what I hear the subject matter to be. So I try to find a way to make biblical principles based on what I hear people saying throughout the week in football, you know. And so that's sort of how I shaped the messages there. In baseball, it was always just sort of, where are we? What's going on with our guys? And, you know, how do you shape a message that's going to apply to them? Because in baseball, you do the visiting team, the home team, and the umpires all on the same day. And then they go play.
And you know, you just said, you know, you don't love basketball that much and all of this. And it's funny. So let's say, no, you are not the reason that Steph Curry hits all those threes. But as a basketball player, I can tell you that having that peace of mind always allowed me to play better. I would much rather go to chapel before a game than to even stretch, even though my body may have needed it more, but my mind needed that chapel. It lets you really kind of wash away anything from that day because it allows you to really focus on what's going on. And it's something powerful about being in a stadium where everybody's hustle, bustle, popcorn and all is going, but you're taking time to say thank you to the one that's responsible for you being here. We don't make ourselves 6'9" or make ourselves that talented. I believe it's because of his grace. So it's so common. And one example, direct example of this, if anybody wants to find it, go Google what Andre Iguodala said after they won the championship 2 years ago when he was the finals MVP, when he said, "I'd like to thank my chaplain because I was going to kill my coach." And so to me, that really means that, you know, just hearing the word every day, sacrificing, all the best tenets of sports allowed, you know, your athletes to calm down and focus in. Could you give us names of any guys that maybe wouldn't mind if you told us that they went to chapel?
Well, I start off with the guys who were with you, AJ, you know.
Avery Johnson. You know, that's Avery Johnson for everybody that don't know out there. That's Avery Johnson.
you know, AJ, you know, that was how we, you know, you were there with AJ.
That's
you
right.
Looked at, you know. Yeah, Chris Jennings, you know, think about some of the old guys
that's right.
That's right. And I think about Steph, but I think about Dale was going to chapel when he was around playing too. So
it's no wonder
to me that Steph would go.
Yeah.
Because he raised his children with that belief system in place. And, you know, and so, you know, you think about James Jones and the different teams he's been on, or RJ, Richard Jefferson, and They're on the Cavs now, but, you know, RJ was with us for a minute. But those guys are, you know, they were part of chapel wherever they've been.
Yes.
It's not just something Mike Miller, wherever Mike has been, he's been the guy to be there, to be involved. And those guys are, you know, besides, you know, our guys, our nucleus, I mean, I think that God has blessed me with the best group of young men in the NBA. You know, sometimes there's not enough chairs when the visitors come, and, you know, like we'll have Portland come and they're joining our chapel, and we have to get more chairs because that's how many guys come from Portland with our guys. And it's just that kind of a thing. And guys are coming, and we get to do something that's so great. We do a fellowship night, and we have a guy from our team speak to the fans after a game.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the things that was great, Chris, is so we asked one guy to speak. And so I was telling the guys in chapel, such and such is going to speak. We've had different guys speak, Harrison, Dre, different guys have spoken. Well, you know what? We had 8 guys show up to support him while he was speaking.
Wow. That's that community you talked about. Wow.
Right. So there weren't just in the room because it was chapel time, but they were a nucleus of each other, that of guys who supported each other. And if that was important for this guy to share, then they should all go out and support him. And they did. And that was awesome because each of those guys that showed up took the mic and shared something with the audience. So it wasn't just that one guy, but each of them shared something about who they were. You know, one guy has Steph said, what music do you listen to? And Steph said, well, I got this guy on now and I'm doing it, you know. Mm-hmm. And that was the guy's question. And so how many people wouldn't listen to that artist after Steph said that's who he's listening to?
Exactly.
You know, right. So.
Wow.
It's just it's amazing, man, what God has allowed to take place through chapel. And, you know, like I told you, Chris, this summer we're going to try to hold a retreat where we actually bring guys together with their spouses and just hold a conference where we can just do training and from all the different teams together under one roof just to share what God is doing in their lives. So it's amazing what's going on.
And I'm glad you talked about that because, you know, on TV, there's a different representation on some of the shows. And so it's great to, you know, let everyone know that there is a balance. And then lastly, when I got, I didn't get traded from Golden State. My contract ended, and I was in a situation where I had just come from one of the toughest situations ever in my life, calling a timeout in front of in front of the world, and faith got me through that. God got me through that. My mother, I came home, and she is a very smart woman, but she's also very funny, and she had a license plate that said time out, you know, that we're going to use this because, you know what, no one can hold anything that's happened against you. We're not going to let that happen. We're going to start foundations, and some kids are going to be helped because you messed up. And so that's the way that we always looked at it. We had to empower ourselves. And then you have to think about it, Rev. And as you know, this coming in, you know, I wanted to play well. Thank God for letting me come to Golden State. I'd never been to the West Coast out there before. And all of a sudden, I had never been a bad guy before. So now all of a sudden the whole world is against you. It's almost like you said, you know, you talked about forgiveness, but what about when you get there? And so for me, oh, it's easy for, you know, oh, let's go through this. And then you have a time when, you know, you're being accused of being defiant. There are a lot of lies going on around you. You have this code where you don't want to talk about things. And so the world can think whatever. And I remember getting a chance to speak to you. I remember getting a chance to talk to Chris Mullin. You know, I had a great village there of people that I could talk to, that it really helped me keep things in perspective. And I think that's what a mentor, a friend, that's what a parent, that's what someone, a confidant can do for you, is to keep you focused while the whole world is swirling out there. And I just want to thank you, because you know what was going on at that time. And I want to thank you for keeping me as strong as you could at that time, and encouraging me at that time, because even if I may have gotten things a day later, that day, 10 years later, it still, I was getting it. It still was in me. And I just like to thank you for all the basketball players and all the football-based players, baseball players that you've helped enrich their lives, and all the chaplains in all of the sports. But for me specifically, Smitty, Reverend Earl Smith, I just want to thank you for being there with me my rookie year, because that helped set the tone. I did go to chapel at every team that I went to that was part of it, but basically because I learned that from being there with those players like Avery Johnson, Keith Jennings, and you. So I just really want to thank you, because that time was, man, that was one of the worst times for me as an athlete, and I just want to thank you for helping me get through that.
Thank you, Chris, man. I'm really proud of you, and like I said, man, my angel still says, oh, there's my boy. I said, he's a grown man now. Quit calling him that.
Nah, I'm a baby. I'm still out.
we're so proud of you, man. We're so proud of what God has done with your life, and the impact that you're having off the court is unbelievable. So God bless you, man.
Oh, well, thank you, Reverend Smith. And talk about your impact off the court and in the lives of others is just something amazing. And when I think about you after reading your book, I think about what a tough childhood that you had, how you were really searching to find yourself there as a child growing up. Could you talk a little bit about the challenges you had as a child? And then let's get into your teenage years, because you were left for dead. and that's not a joke. That's just the truth. And you shouldn't be with us right now. Can you talk a little bit about your journey into finding your calling?
Yeah, I think when I talk about my mom, I'll go to that first. There's a lot of times people don't understand people's stories. There was something I was searching for, hoping to get from my mom, and she didn't have the capacity to give it to me the way I wanted. So I therefore blamed her for a lot of things that she didn't have the capacity to give. Hmm. My mom had endured some amazing things just to get to where she was. And without knowing that, I put a lot of blame on her in the process, and we call that transference. I transferred a lot of my anger towards her to other people. So I got in a lot of trouble early in my life, in and out of the system, being stopped by police, whatever else. And, you know, my dad was always there. My dad was my coach. He was that guy, alcoholic, part of the church. On the board for the church and this other stuff. But yet, what I realized early on in terms of a relationship with Christ was people are human. Mm-hmm. I was angry with my mom, and in hindsight, as I got older and started to process it, what I like to tell people about that I wanted to sort of bring forth in the book was the thought that people can be angry. So when I talk to people, I can say, they say, well, yeah, that was me. And then I always ask, did she have the tools in the box that you needed? Was she capable of giving you what she needed with the tools she had? And because a lot of people grow up not realizing that situation exists. For my dad, he was my best friend. And so whatever situation I was in, he was always the guy that was there to sort of tell me we're going to get through this. When I got shot, I got shot 6 times, and, you know, my mom didn't come see me at the hospital, but my dad did. And I remember I'm laying on this gurney, shot up, and the doctor's expecting me to die. And he said, son, this is bad, but we're going to get through it. We're going to get through it. So he didn't abandon me at that point, but he said he was with me even through that. And that was some of the things that really kept me going, Chris, was just the thought that he was always there to support me.
You know, let's talk a little bit about that. You talk in the book, you say baseball was a big part of your life. And Game 7 in the World Series where Joe Morgan's run, scoring that single with two outs in the top of the ninth. You know, the Cincinnati Reds defeated the Red Sox 4-3, but you remember that night, you know, for a different reason. And could you talk a little bit, because the reason why I brought up your mother and I brought up your father is because I think that it gave you, and this situation we're going to talk about, I think it gave you a unique outlook at forgiveness and grace, because you say some interesting things about your relationship with the fellow athlete that you said you should not have recruited to sell drugs. Could you talk a little bit about that night of Game 7 of the 1975 World Series and that attempt on your life? And then how did you change your life around?
Yeah, you know, one of the things that happened on that day was I went out golfing, and we would go on the golf course because we didn't want the police to sort of see what we were doing, and we would make transactions and discuss business. Well, I'm out there. I got my gun in my golf bag. We're golfing. I get home. I'm rushing home to see the World Series. I'm a baseball fanatic, been one all my life. My dad, my grandfather, they played. My Uncle Spurgeon was Satchel Paige's relief pitcher. So I grew up understanding and loving baseball. So I get home in time to see the game, and I'm there at the door. There's a knock at the door. I look, and I see it's a kid named Michael, and he has this guy with him I don't know. But Michael owed me some money because I had got him recruited to sell drugs. And he was a real good – Michael's a good kid. Michael should never – I shouldn't have never done it. Michael was like this really great athlete that I had no business getting involved in my business. But now he owed me money, and people knew he did. So he's scared because he knows what that means. Mm. He brings this guy – they come in, he gets to the door, he says, I came to pay you. I said, okay, come in. But I'm watching the game, and I'm thinking about what do I have to do to him to make an example so people on the street will know you can't just get away with this.
Wow.
And the thing I learned from that before I go any further is there's a big difference between respect and fear. I thought I was having respect by virtue of how I was living, but what I was doing was building up fear. And when you build up fear, people will do some amazing things to get away and combat that fear that they feel. So they're sitting there, I'm watching a game, and then I see him give a signal like a gun handle, shooting a gun, and this guy, Stevie, just stands up and starts shooting me. Once again, my gun is in my golf bag. The one I would normally keep under my couch is not there. So I have nothing to grab. And, you know, I got up under a table. He shot through the table. That bullet hit me. And then he just stood there clicking the gun. And then Michael told him, okay, that's enough. Let's go.
Wow.
Well, the police had me under surveillance on the corner, so they saw what went on. But, you know, and what I say is that wasn't personal. It was business because I had put myself in a position to make it not personal by virtue of what I did. A lot of people process things and think that it's personal when it's really business. And you hold on to anger and bitterness because you made it personal, whereas the person that did it, they move on about their business. They no longer associate with it. I mean, I had a guy that I had a shootout with, and I'm at a park, and he says, do you remember me? I said, no. He says, you got to remember me. I said, no, I don't. I have my kids with me. He says, well, I'm Mexican Manuel, and we had a shootout.
Oh, wow.
I say, okay, my kids are all freaking out. And I said, no, I'm sorry, I don't remember you. And what that told me is that shootout for him was really a big deal.
Right, exactly.
For me, it wasn't personal. It was just something that happened, and I moved on. Sometimes we don't know how to move on.
And that's what I want to, as we continue the story, there's going to be so many points like that you make, because you talked about, first of all, the difference between respect and fear. Secondly, you talked about business and personal. And then, you know, pretty soon we're going to talk about the executions that you had to oversee. We're going to talk about forgiveness. Do people deserve it? You wrote the first manual to kind of the protocol to how to counsel families of those murdered victims, and how to counsel the victims, and then how to counsel the actual perpetrator of those murders. And so I really want to break down a lot of these topics with you. And so we've talked about your mother and the fact you had to understand she only could give you what you're capable of. We talked about your father and the fact that he was there for you and he supported you even though he had those issues. And, you know, let's talk about that this night, because I think once we talk about the night in the hospital room, when we understand how you were called, then we can kind of get into all of the amazing things that you've done with athletes that I know personally and inmates in jail that maybe we'll never get a chance to see or meet. And so what was it like that night, laying in the hospital bed with holes in your face and your spine and your back?
Well, you know what happened? As I was laying there, the doctor came in, my dad's there, and my dad asked the doctor, how bad is it? He tells my dad he's not going to make it. And my dad grabs him and says, doctor, you better do what you do best. And I'm sort of laying there. You know, when you get shot, it's like hot pokers in you. So I'm burning up. Mm. And I'm on this metal gurney, and they're just waiting on me to die. I mean, I was shot in my face, my neck, my back, my arms, my legs. I had 7 holes in me. 1 bullet went in, came out, went back into another part of my body. So they didn't know how many times I was shot.
Right.
And my dad, when he said that, he went away to pray. And the doctor walked away because he didn't think there was anything he could do. And, Chris, the thing that happened was, it was like all of a sudden the burning stops, literally just stops.
Wow.
And there's like this unbelievable peace that comes to me while I'm laying there. And this voice says, you're not going to die. I have something for you to do. You're going to be a chaplain at San Quentin Prison.
Now, wait, let's talk about this, Rev, because I know people are going to say, hold on, you know, and I really, you know, because, you know, for those of you listening, I've known Reverend Earl Smith since I was 23 years, and I did not know any of this until the book. And so when you talk and you walk with him, you just know him as a man of faith, a man of character. You really don't know someone's story and how they got there. And so when you say you heard a voice, was the voice, do you think, in the room? Was it something that spoke in your spirit? Could you just kind of elaborate?
No, I literally felt like I heard a voice speaking to me. I really will tell you, I heard a voice, and it was so real that I started to laugh. And the doctor was away from the gurney, and he thought I was going into shock.
Wow.
He comes in, and I look at him. Remember, I was burning. Now I'm at peace. And I said, doc, if I tell you where the bullets are, will it help? And he looks at me with this weird face, and he says, no. But I pointed at my nose where one of the bullets had gone in, and that hole closed up. I pointed at my neck where another bullet had gone in. That hole closed up. And as I was pointing to where the bullets were, where the bullets had gone in, the holes closed up. The doctor didn't know what was going on, but it was that voice. It was clear that voice told me. And only through that voice was I able to say where the bullets were, where they had gone in, because what happened in my face, because I was shot in my face was swollen up, so you really couldn't tell what was going on. One bullet had cut into my face and went back into my neck, and it's on top of my heart still to this day. They never took it out. So I'm telling the doctor what's going on. So literally, the only thing he had to stitch up with me from all those bullets was that place in my face that the bullet cut through my face. Everything else closed up.
Wow.
3 days later, my dad takes me home.
This is amazing, because when you talk about that respect, I love what you talk about in the book. You say that prison is the one place you can't have a mask on. You know, the rumors get out, people will dissect you real quick. And I think that it was very important for us to understand that a man like you that goes into the toughest place in the world, that uses sports as a way to keep peace in the toughest, one of the toughest places in the world, you kind of have to be built for it, called for it. And it seems that your life, you would understand, as you understand, it wasn't business. It wasn't personal. It was business. When the kid that you recruited, you just said you should not have recruited the young athlete, Stephen Moore, to come to the house. And, you know, it's almost like you have to have that sobering honesty and understanding your calling. And if we could talk a little about San Quentin. And in your book, you state that it's 432 acres. I've been there before, overlooking the bay. It's actually some of the most beautiful houses. I have a friend that stays right in the area across from it where you could see it, and it's amazing. His house is, I don't know how much, but I can't imagine how the property value that the prison is sitting on. I mean, you can see the bay. It's about 12 miles from the Golden Gate Bridge. It was built in 1852, and, you know, you talk about how in 1937, the noose was replaced there with lethal gas. That they had had over 200 people hang there between 1893 and 1937. And I just like to ask you some basic questions for our listeners out there before we kind of get into the amazing things that you did.
Hey, Chris, can I tell you the kid I recruited that was selling drugs for me? His name was Michael.
Okay,
the kid that he got was a guy that was actually recruited to shoot me, and his name was Stephen Moore. He was not from Stockton. He was someone that was recruited and paid basically to shoot me. He was a gang member that came into town, and Michael, the guy that did it, he was just doing what he could to survive. But he didn't shoot.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Stephen. Michael recruited, yes. Steve,
yeah, so I want to make sure that, because, you know, I feel bad to this day about what I got Michael into, and I need you to understand, Michael should never have been involved. I was involved from a kid up. I could have got all kinds of people selling drugs for me. I didn't need Michael.
Right.
So I was wrong. You know, I was wrong for doing that.
You know, and well, let's stick on this, you know, because there are so many people, when I grew up, in Detroit, there were so many drug dealers that would not let me get in trouble because they saw my potential. They would tell me to go home or leave. They're about to start shooting here. What are you doing at this party? And so, you know, that is another aspect of society that young athletes, young men in general, have to go through, you know, kind of the pressures of the recruitment or the fact that you want to live this glorious life like you think the other, you know, drug dealers are doing, and you don't realize the issues and the problems that you go through. So, no, we totally understand, because as we get into something amazing is going to happen, and I don't want to give your whole book away, having to make sure people go get Death Row Chaplain, Reverend Earl Smith. It's unbelievable. True stories from America's most notorious prison. Once again, he's the chaplain for the Golden State Warriors, the San Francisco 49ers, and for 10 years or so, he was at the San Francisco Giants. Let's talk a little bit about San Quentin. What type of individuals have you worked with, and what type of a place? In the book, you say that we take for granted the monotony of the prison, and if you could talk about the code, just the culture of prison, because in some ways, when you talk about the diversity, it definitely mirrors society as far as you were talking about the diversity or the divide because of religion, race, other things. Could you just talk a little bit about the culture?
Well, you know, prison is a microcosm of what you see in society. You have race, you have religion, you have structure. You have a caste system where people in prison have more than others, and so they pry upon the least fortunate. And prison, when I got there, it was like the prison was locked down like 13 of the first 16 months I was there. When they let guys out, there'd be a stabbing or a killing. Go back to being locked up. You know, you never knew when you were going to go home or not. You see a bunch of guys in the summertime with pea coats on. You knew somebody was going to get stabbed by 3 o'clock so they could go in you know, it was that kind of a place. And at that point, San Quentin was the worst. San Quentin was the last stop there. The across from the chapel, they had the Adjustment Center, which was the jail inside the jail. In 71, that's where George Jackson tried to escape from. And a number of officers, as well as George and a couple other people, were killed right in that area by where the chapel is. So, you know, that's the kind of place it was. San Quentin was the kind of place where you never knew when someone might get killed. You never knew how things were. There was a system. But yet within that system, there were laws. And if you violated the law, it was understood what you would get. And to maneuver through that and to start to see people that I knew in that system and living, it was eye-opening for me because, you know, you come from the streets, but you don't know you don't have a clue what you're getting ready to get into when you go to work in a prison. Mm-hmm. As a chaplain, especially, because I knew the streets, but I didn't know prison. I didn't know how to operate in prison as a free person that was doing something legitimate. And that was a whole different thing.
I saw you on an interview, I believe it was in 700 Club, and you talked about the difference between you and the prisoners were that you had a pass to go in and out every day, that grace, that the grace of God was just was with you. And you talk about how you talk to prisoners about you may have to pay for your actions, but you are no longer your actions. And I want to talk to you a little bit about how can you put hope in such a dark place. But let me ask you this. You just said that prison has rules, and I'm just going to let you talk because this book is so amazing. When you talk about the prison has rules, and you said it has its own culture and society, could you just talk a little bit about how you use sports to manipulate that society?
Well, sure. In prison, things are separated by race and religion, as I was saying, Chris. So you end up with a situation where blacks play with blacks, whites play with blacks, Hispanics play with Hispanics, Pacific Islanders play with Pacific Islanders, and there's all these little systems. And they would play against each other, but you could never play on another team. And yet we know that that's not sports. So I remember bringing a softball team in from a church called Bethel Church in San Jose, and I just thought I'd get a bunch of inmates together and they'd play them. And this team had gone from prison to prison and they hadn't lost. What I didn't know was everywhere they went, they were playing just against individual ethnic groups. They weren't playing against a prison team. Mm. So they get there and I say, okay, guys, we need to get a guy, you know, and I'm sort of telling it. Well, the guy said, we're not going to play with them. I said, what? We can't play with them. So when I asked this softball team, they had like 20 players. So I said, can you guys split up and play against each other? They said, what? I said, the inmates don't want to play you, but they need to see that there could have been a game that they could have been involved in. And they said, okay. So they played, and the inmates were all watching. They watched how they played. And then I escorted them out of the chapel. And, you know, we went to the chapel, had some drinks with some of the guys that were in the chapel. They brought canned sodas for guys, ice coolers. And, you know, they were looking for a really great time on the yard. They didn't get it. Well, then the leaders of different groups came and said, hey, if you bring those guys back, we agree to let our guys play.
Wow.
And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, just this one time they could play because this team had never lost.
Now,
right?
When you say leaders of the group, because I want people to get clear, because when you went there, you were a little worried about maybe seeing people in the Black Gorilla family that you had known, and you didn't want that to throw the wrong message. And so you're talking about the Mexican mafia. Am I correct? When you say the leaders, you mean the
the
different.
I'm talking about the ME or the Mexican mafia, the NF, the Socios Familia, Crips, Bloods, the Black Gorilla family. In fact, one of my crime partners was the squadron captain for the BGF, which I didn't know when I got there, but I found out later. And so, you know, this word comes down that it's okay for them to play this one time because there's a structure in place, and they had to get permission, but they wanted to play, and they thought they were sort of intrigued about what it could be. So we invite this church back, and, I mean, the yard is full because this hadn't happened where you're going to have – And we had guys from every ethnic group, from every different group, their best. We had their best. And all their guys were cheering, but they weren't just cheering for their guy. They were cheering for the San Quentin guys who were playing these outsiders. And what they didn't realize that I knew would happen, it brought a sense of community for the length of time it took to play that game.
Right.
And when you introduce community to any oppressed situation, you change the tenor, you change the message that's going on in that situation. So that one game changed the thought process of the prison, because for that one day, they realized they could be enemies. They could be totally opposed to each other, but they found something that could be that in common that they could do, and that was playing this softball game, and that they could root for their guys that played and feel good about it.
It's Thanksgiving week in America, and to show you how thankful we are that you listen to this show every week, Podcast One wants to give you 2 free months of exclusive access to Podcast One premium content, where you get thousands of shows from the likes of Adam Carolla, Shaq, Steve Austin, Brandy Glanville, Dan Patrick, and so many more. To get your 2 free months of premium, go to PodcastOne.com now, enter your email address, and we'll take care of the rest.
And I'm so glad that you said that. I mean, basically, you're saying what Nelson Mandela's quote says, is that sport can bring hope to where there was once only despair. And, you know, really basically what you're saying is nothing brings us together like a common enemy. The fact that the inmates there had to be together to kind of beat this outside team, that just shows, like you say, anytime you introduce community to an area or to a divided people, obviously, that just becomes just a great motivator. And I guess that's what you're saying, that's what you did there at San Quentin State Prison.
Yeah, and really it did. And I mean, the fact that when they won, they beat this team, naturally. And when they won, they congratulated each other.
Wow.
And for some of them, that might have been the first time that they actually had a decent conversation with someone from another group, ethnic group,
exactly,
or whatever, but it was okay because they had permission to drop their guard and be a human being, to be just a person. And what sports does, you know, I tell big people all the time, baseball is the best game, and I know you play basketball, in the world, because what it does, it teaches people how to be a failure, not a success. You you fail 7 times, you're successful 3 times. People love you because you batted 300.
Mm, good point.
So when I started sports in the prison with baseball, I took that same concept, because you're a failure by virtue of how you end up in prison. People say you're incarcerated. When you get to San Quentin, oh, he's incarcerated at San Quentin. I say, no, you're detained at San Quentin. You were incarcerated by something. And the byproduct of your incarceration is you ended up in San Quentin.
Hmm.
But until we deal with environmental and generational and economic incarceration, we're going to continue to see people detained in man-made facilities. So you have to attack those structures. And the way you attack those structures is by bringing people that are not known to associate together to talk about what their commonalities are. What are the things you have in common? The difference is, you know, but let's discuss your things that you have in common. And sports does that.
You know, and you quote right here, I just like to read this from your book again, Death Row Chaplain. As I look back, I think reintroducing baseball to San Quentin Prison was one of the crowning achievements of my career as chaplain. As I look at the players who got out and became productive citizens, many of whom are making a profound impact on their communities, I have to believe that playing baseball made a difference in their lives. I think it provided them with camaraderie, responsibility, and a sense of pride that they wouldn't have had otherwise found inside those walls. For a few hours, a couple of days a week, there were no steel bars, handcuffs, or iron gates imprisoning them. You know, let me ask you this. What would you say to those that say, wait a minute, they don't deserve this. These are prisoners. They don't deserve recreational time or to play sport. What would you say?
I would first of all say that these guys are not going to get out and go to some place called Ex-Conville. They're going to go back to the communities that they were arrested in. And the choice is send them back the way they came in or send them back as change, which means that they may be a difference maker in the community. If we send them back the same way they were arrested, have we really done, what have we really done other than prove that they could do time? So if sport is the one thing that can trigger something in their mind to make them feel that they can be different, that they no longer have to be what they were, I tell guys, you're not your crime. You committed a crime, but who really are you? And if sport is what brings out who they really are, and in understanding who they really are, it means that they won't go back and commit a crime again. They won't go back and be a blight on society or harm other people. They're going to live next door to somebody's mom. Do you want them living next door to someone's mom the same way they came to prison or change, having dealt with people from society, seeing a different thing about how they can live? And if we do that properly, then that helps the community. So if it's sport that helps the community be more safer, then let them have sport.
You know, I'd like to hear one more story, if you could. When you were talking about playing chess against an Aryan leader, and I can only imagine, you know, it sounded like a movie as I read it, you know, that all the different gangs are cheering, hoping that they beat you. And that's the thing. I think it brings that common enemy, like you said, that community. Could you just tell us a little bit about that story? Because to me, you know, even more than everyday society where, you know, we don't know who that Aryan leader is because, you know, we don't interact or can't see the tattoos. I mean, you're here and they're not scared to tell you how they feel. Could you just talk a little bit about chess and how chess and the game of chess brought you together with these gentlemen, also allowed you to recruit them for chapel?
Well, you know, the way we played chess was every Thursday was my last day of work for the week. And I would go into that adjustment center that I was talking about, which is the jail inside the jail. It was, at that time, it was the most secure place in the California prison system. And I always made sure I played a black guy, a white guy, and a Hispanic guy. And what I would do in playing them is we had to call out our plays. Whatever move you made, you call it out. So it started with me playing, and a guy said, "Hey, what was that move? What did you do?" And so we'd say the move again, and somebody say, "Louder." Well, that meant somebody else was listening. So then we would say it, and, you know, it's three tiers there. There's three floors. We call them tiers. And so they're sort of communicating. Everyone's hearing. And guy make a bad move, boom, you know, you know, those aren't just black guys booing or white guys or Hispanic booing. That's all his people that are booing because he made a bad move. So he's no longer playing me. They're all playing me. Mm-hmm. And I'm playing all of them. And, you know, so it got the pressures on because he needs to beat me. He has to beat me. And I have to make sure he doesn't beat me because I've got to come back and play again. And there are some unbelievable, there's guys in there, Chris, that play chess against me that would take a queen and a rook off the board and tell me move first.
Oh man.
And still beat me, you know, and I used to teach chess.
Right.
These guys are just that good. And so, but in playing them, I had to figure out how do you communicate and communicate, the more you play, the more a guy will open up because now he's seeing you're doing something he does. You're doing something he knows how to do. And we did that. And it was like an unbelievable experience because, I mean, I didn't win all the games. Yet when I didn't win, it was amazing because I had to walk off the tier and they're booing me and they're telling the guard, "Don't let him off yet." And they're booing me some more. But you know what? On that Thursday, they knew the next Thursday I was going to come back and some other guys were going to get to play me. And that became their day. At the end of their day, after they came, I waited till they got off the yard. They're through for the day. They're locked down totally. And that's when we played.
I think that, you know, and I'm not going to give this story away, but you also got dominoes and you, that's how you kind of got Geronimo Pratt, and also that's kind of, you know, with the good food that you were bringing in, I'm sure your wife Angel was probably making it for you. I know you can't cook like she can, but, you know, it's a wonderful story about how you share that spirit of forgiveness and you are not your crime, and you get Huey P. Newton and Geronimo Pratt together. I'm not going to tell every story, but that's just a wonderful story. And I think part of your outreach in that, letting people understand that you have to be respected as a man first, and then they'll listen to what you say. I really like your approach to that. And now that we've talked about kind of how close you've gotten to these guys, some of them, how you've worked with them, you know, you've even played chess with Charles Manson, and you were there when he was scaring Geraldo on that famous night. you were saying that he was kind of playing with Geraldo, just scaring him just to kind of toy with him and show his power to people. And I thought that was a wonderful story, a funny story.
And, yeah, he was being Charles, and Geraldo didn't. You know, the thing that was interesting, Geraldo had this scoop. He was going to have this great interview, and Charles had another plan, and his plan worked.
Exactly. You know, and chess was your game, and if you could tell us now, we're probably going to get serious, even more serious, because, you know, I believe that you had four men on death row during your time go away innocent. Am I correct?
Actually, I think I had six, and there's another guy I got to get out. They went home, they're back in society at home. One of the guys, Gary, passed away after he got out, Bigelow, but yeah, there's guys that were on death row that went home. Yes.
And when you talk about that, everyone can't go home. And you talk about in the book, forgiveness and justice. You talk about, a inmate, who, asked you to ask the sister, I believe, of a family member that he killed forgive him. And if you could tell this story, because my question, I have two questions. When was the last time you played chess? And secondly, why, I know you feel this way, but what do you feel about closure? And why do you feel that the death penalty is not the answer?
Well, you know, it was Robert Harris, and what he asked, we had sat down and he had written letters to the families of both of his victims. And one of the families wrote back saying, "We forgive you, but we want you to be executed." The other family never responded. So on the night of the execution, we were sitting there, we've been playing chess, sort of just passing the time, really. I mean, how do you pass the time with someone? You know, chaplains are supposed to be people of hope. Yet when you deal with the execution process, you're a person of finality. And because of finality, you have to introduce what the process is beyond death. Well, part of that was him understanding the process of forgiveness. So he says, will you go ask her, will she forgive me? So I knew where she was because they housed the victim's family members, the witnesses, the family women. They're all in different locations. So I went to where she was. I asked her, could I speak to her for a minute? I introduced myself, and I said, Robert Harris asked me if you will forgive him. And she says to me, tell him I said no. And I said, okay. So I get back. You know, this is a long walk, so I walk back, I finally get back, and he's waiting. What did she say? And I sat down in the chair outside of his cell. I said, Robbie, she said no. And he just sort of slumped, and he said, wow. And the problem with saying no was he wasn't asking, will you try to tell them not to execute me? He was just trying to say, I want to be separated from what I did, and I want you to know I feel bad. I'm grieved about my crime. I'm grieved about what I've done to you and your family. And I want you to understand I'm grieved. And that's really what forgiveness is saying. I'm grieved. I'm hurt that I've hurt you so much. and I need you to understand. I can't change it, but I'm sorry for what I've done." She said, "No." Well, so the process moves forward, and Robbie's executed. And I'm staying there with them, and they all walked out. I'm the last one in the chamber, and I'm looking at him slumped in that chair. And then I go to where the people are that were witnesses, because I'm really going to see how they're doing. And this lady, when I walk through the door, she runs up and grabs me by my neck and just her arms around my neck, and she's yelling. She's saying it in my ear, "Did you tell him I forgave him? Did you tell him I forgave him?" And Chris, I had to literally pull her arms off my neck. And I looked her in the eye and I said, "You told me to tell him no." Now, for the remainder of her life, she thinks about three things: her brother being killed and how much that affected her family, her parents dying without seeing anything come of it. She has to think about, she watched someone be executed, which was court sanctioned. It was what the law of the land said should happen for the crime he committed. And she had to think about, the one thing he asked her to do was forgive him, and she said no. And whatever that means, whether she could live with herself or not beyond that, on that particular occasion, on that night, well, it's actually the morning. It was like 6:30 in the morning by the time they executed him. It was 6:18. She has to process. I said no. What did that do for me? What did that do for him? And what do I do now? I don't know what she does now. I mean, I can tell you what I know about her since then, but I won't. But what I can tell you is she didn't get anything that she thought she was going to get out of that.
And that's the purpose, Reverend, is that, you know, like you said, he wasn't asking for her not to be. I think that's part of the story that touched me so much. When you talk about forgiveness, is that he wasn't asked to be he wasn't asking that he couldn't be executed. He was asked to be separated from his crime. And I think that a lot of people can understand that. And so what would the cynic say to you? Let's see. They would say to you, "Well, Reverend, what situation have you been in when you've had to forgive life or death?" Could you talk a little bit about, you were approximately, I think, 5 months in, and it was Christmas, and you were passing out Christmas cards, your first year there at San Quentin. Could you talk a little bit about your experience with having to forgive? I just thought it sent a shiver through my spine when you talk about this moment, walking on the tier, giving away Christmas cards.
Sure, I'll tell you that. But to answer your other question that you asked me about playing chess, the last time I played chess was with Robert Harris. It was the night he was executed, and you know, I was so competitive that he was dying. I knew he was going to die, but I couldn't let him win. And I realized that anything that had that much control over my life, I probably shouldn't do it anymore. So I just said I wasn't going to play anymore. And since he was executed, I've never played another game.
Let me ask you something about that, Reverend. My first thought would be that as his friend, as someone that he had a great relationship with, to me it would seem that you owe him that. Like, as an athlete, I know we're talking about a serious subject, but let's take it less serious. My brother's going away for school for a long time, or something's going to happen. Well, I might have to try to bust you up on purpose just to let you know that everything is normal. You didn't look at it that way. You looked at it like your competitive spirit, like you just need to let this go right now, huh?
Well, what I looked at was, Chris, was he and I went back and forth.
Okay.
And he would win sometime, I would win sometime, and I didn't have the mechanism to say, okay, it's okay to let Robbie win this time.
Okay, you didn't have it, so you had to, okay, I get it. You were working on yourself with that then. You didn't have the mechanism
No, I didn't have the mechanism, you know, and not to have that mechanism means that thing really, I was really under control of that chess stuff, man.
Right.
I loved chess. I loved playing it. I love talking about it. I love beating people. And I didn't have that mechanism, man. You know, it's like, you know, you play with your little brother, you say sometimes you might just let him win for the sake of letting him win so he feel so he'll come back.
Right.
No.
I hear that. and when we talk about, you know, forgiveness, and then, you know, thank you so much. And once again, I'm talking to my chaplain, my first chaplain when I got into the NBA. His name is Reverend Earl Smith. He's written Death Row Chaplain, Unbelievable True Stories from America's Most Notorious Prisons. And just a couple more questions. If I would love for you to tell your story of forgiveness, because you told us earlier how you dove under a table, you were shot 6 times, had 7 holes in your body, you heard the clicking of the shooter still trying to shoot. If he had 100 more bullets, you would have been shot 100 more times. Can you talk about 5 months in, handing out Christmas cards on the gangland tier there in San Quentin?
Yeah, you know, I was on probation. That's the thing that's really strange about it. When I got hired, you had a 6-month probationary period. I got hired in July, so December, you know, I needed to get through all the way through January and June into February to get off probation. And I'm giving out these Christmas cards. I'm on the second tier in North Block, and it was an affiliated tier where guys were sort of getting processed to see if they would get moved around to the other side, to the BGF side. So they were sort of waiting for processing, but that's where they were housed. And I'm going along, and I see this guy, and when I look at him, he sort of jumps away from the bars. And I say to him, "Hey, man, what's your name?" And his response was, "I got shot too." And when he said that, I realized, yes, he was, you know, that was Stephen Moore, the guy that shot me. And wow. His answer was, you know, then he says, "My name's Ace." And so I'm looking at him and I realized, man, all that schooling, all that talk about forgiveness, it was just a bunch of talk, Chris. Mm. You can talk about it all you want, but when you confront it with the thing that's harmed you the most, mm. when you're confronted with the thing that has changed your life, mm-hmm. then you have to really decide, what does that change mean? Mm-hmm. So I'm walking down the tier, and I realize if I just tell such and such who's on the other side, he's the guy that shot me, I don't have to ask him to do anything to the guy. He would just do it because of what he did to me.
Right.
But now I'm the chaplain. You know, and so I'm walking down the tier giving out Christmas cards, and man, tears just start flooding down my face, and I couldn't even say Merry Christmas, and the guys were like, "What's wrong?" And then it's all of a sudden, there's something wrong with the chaplain, there's something wrong with Smitty, you know, because I couldn't say anything. But God has a very interesting way of making you deal with your situations, because at the end of that tier is a gate. The only way that you can get off is turn around and go back the way you came. Mm. So in turning around and going back the way I came, I had to once again go in front of a cell. And as I got there, I had all these emotions, and I thought I was angry. And when I looked at him, I looked at what his condition was, and I just looked at him and said, "Hey, man, I need to thank you, because God used you to get to me." Mm. I didn't know where those words came from. But I'll tell you this, Chris, I was in ministry. I was going all over the place speaking to groups. And I didn't realize the burden I was carrying from place to place until I told him those words. I left that tier. I went back to my office. And, I mean, I cried and I cried and I cried. But you know what those tears were? Those tears were shedding the burden and the weight that I didn't even realize I had.
Right. Wow.
That until I confronted him and was able to say, "God used you to get to me, and I need to thank you," I didn't realize what all that really meant. Now, he didn't believe me. He writes a letter to the warden saying, "You got to get me out of this prison. The chaplain's going to have me killed." So they call me in, and I tell Mr. Jackson, I said, "Yes, he shot me." And you know, I said, "You know, I've been shot, because when I got hired, there were x-rays and they could see where bullets were in my body." I said, "But I want to let you know, he's in the safest place he'll ever be right now." So Mr. Jackson just says, "Okay, you can leave. What I didn't know was Mr. Jackson arranged to have him transported by himself in a vehicle to another prison. And he did that because had he not done that, I would have been fired. He did that so that guy could leave. Now, if I had not said that to him, I do not believe Mr. Jackson's heart would have been sensitive enough to let me stay there and have that guy move. I believe God orchestrated all of that in order to see how because we still have choice. We still have choice when it's all said and done. I believe God orchestrated it to see if I, in fact, would yield to his voice and do what he was telling me to do, or if I would still be that person that wanted to control my own situations. By doing that, I believe George, he also saw from Mr. Jackson's heart. So Mr. Jackson, who was the associate warden, said, okay, and he moved that guy. And I was able to stay at San Quentin.
I know people are listening saying, I cannot believe these stories. And I'm telling you, I know this man and I trust him and I know him, and he's a man of faith. And these are incredible stories, and hopefully they will inspire you. Hopefully they will make you think about forgiveness. Hopefully they'll make you question what you think about, even have a debate with others that you're listening to. But this is a man that's lived it, that's been in the game, got out of the game, had to forgive. And in the most serious sense of the word, he had to practice what he preached that day, walking down a tear. I can only imagine you walking with tears in your eyes back the opposite way. Because you have to, you know, I think, you know, forgiveness, you know how they say courage is acting in the face of fear. I think, you know, forgiveness is acting in the face of emotion. You know, if you didn't feel anything, like you said, you know, what are you forgiving if it didn't bring up anything like that? And just talk for a second about one more incredible story. It is about forgiveness, and I do not understand the power of this person's forgiveness. It was just amazing. Talk about an inmate who was convicted of a very vicious crime. His name is Kevin H. in the book. And if you could talk about him and the female guard who used to just watch both of you like a hawk while you were trying to speak and minister to him. Can you talk about that relationship?
Oh, you're talking about Kevin?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. You know, Kevin, this kid, Kevin, was on one of my tiers that I was assigned to, and whenever I would go visiting that tier, the gun officer would sort of trail me from the rail, from the guard rail, from the gun rail, and she would sort of stop when I would talk to this kid. I never thought much of it. I thought she was just sort of spotting me because it was in a lockup facility. It was in a high care lockup facility, and so I finally shared with Kevin the gospel to the point where he accepted Christ in his life, and he wanted to be baptized. So I write a letter saying we'd like to get him escorted to the chapel, and he had to be in chains to be escorted over. We had a baptistry where we actually, it's like a baptismal that they have at a church. We actually had it at the prison. And so his escort is this gun officer. Still don't think much of it. And then Kevin says, I want to hear this song. And he said a couple of words. I said, well, Kevin, I don't know that song. And she says, I know it. Let me sing it. And she sings this song, and she has tears in her eyes. And I'm like, well, you know, we had our officers get emotional about stuff. I couldn't figure it all out. I was baptizing Kevin, and you know, and I was thankful that she brought him over. And so I did the baptism, and she escorts him back, and she comes back over to me sometime later. She says, I need to let you know something. I said, okay. We sit down. I know her name by then. I'm not going to mention it. And she says, I need to let you know that he's in here for raping my daughter.
Wow.
And I thought that if I could get to work in a prison, if I ever saw him, I could kill him for what he did to my daughter. And she said, I saw Christ come into his cell, and my hatred and my anger left. And she says, I don't know how I was allowed to be his escort, but God made me his escort in order that I could be there when he was baptized. And that was probably, of the stories that I wrote about in there, that was probably one of the most profound moments of my life, because it just told me the power of forgiveness, but also the power of God. You know, that place was a dungeon. It was a dingy place. We called it the Bastille by the Bay. It was like the end of the line. And yet at the end of the line, there was God. And God was doing some amazing things. So in her particular case, her life changed because she did get the job. But then after that, she resigned. Not long after that, she resigned from working for the Department of Corrections. And I think God needed her there doing that in order to help her heal to move forward. She didn't know it, but God did.
This is Smitty, Reverend Earl Smith, Death Row Chaplain. Unbelievable stories, unbelievable true stories from America's most notorious prison. Go get this book, Reverend Earl Smith, Death Row Chaplain. And Reverend Earl, thank you for your time. And in your book, lastly, you talk about how people, and you talked even in this conversation, how people are institutionalized before they got to prison. And so I would suspect that you mean that for a lot of us out here, whether mentally, whether physically, whether it's a substance or anything that you know, what would you say to those of us that are incarcerated in our own lives? What do you say in chapel? You know, what would you say to us, as far as someone that's seen guys on death row, someone that's seen guys before their last minutes on earth, that's seen true regrets, what would you say? What would you say to us?
I would say, first of all, that usually whatever that is that's incarcerating you, it's binding you up, and you don't even begin to know what you can accomplish when there's liberty in your life. You really don't understand what God is able to do. So I would say to people that are finding themselves bound and shackled by, you know, where I say it, environmental incarceration, generational incarceration, economic incarceration, mental incarceration, emotional incarceration, intellectual incarceration, what I would say to you is the only way that you will be able to find liberty and freedom is when you come to grips with what that is that is binding you. So many of us put on cosmetics and we put on a facade that we're okay and we're not okay. And the longer we act, the longer it takes us to remember who we really are. But when you finish acting, when you quit, when you decide that no longer are you going to act like you're okay when you're really not, is when healing can really start. So what I tell guys, you know, I tell guys, you're not your crime. And I tell people, you know, there's generations of people that have been detained in prison systems, and kids grow up incarcerated because their families are incarcerated. And you don't have to be incarcerated. There is liberty, and the liberty that I found for myself was in my relationship with Christ, because only in that, and then even after I found it, it was only when I confronted that thing that still had me incarcerated, which was unforgiveness, was I able to really find liberty. That day I went to my chapel and cried, that was my liberty. That was my breakthrough. I didn't realize I was still shackled. I was living a great life. People were saying great things about me. They were talking about how much my life had changed. I was still shackled until I admitted that there was something still holding me. And that would be the same thing I would say to each of everyone. If there's something that you know that you're just getting by, and quickly I'll say this, a lot of people wear cosmetics, and the value of cosmetics is to cover up blemishes. When you decide to take the cosmetics off and realize the blemishes are not as bad as you once thought, and you're not the only one with blemishes, is when you'll see what God can really do. And closing with this is what my dad told me once, Chris. I made an error in a baseball game and we lost. And I got in the car, I could only call him dad in the car, not coach on the field, and I was crying. He said, what's wrong? I said, I made an error. He said, what's wrong? I said, you know what's wrong. I made an error and we lost. And he said to me, son, there's a name for it. You're not going to do it. And I would say to a lot of people that may be listening or thinking right now, if there's a name for what you're going through, you're not the first one that's going through it. and there was victory for someone else, so there should be victory for you.
That's Reverend Earl Smith. He just wrote a book, Death Row Chaplain, Unbelievable True Stories from America's Most Notorious Prisons. And we'd like to thank him for being on our show today and challenging us on our conventional thought about forgiveness, about second chances, about how sport can change a system. As we talked about Nelson Mandela's quote earlier, where there is despair, sport can provide inspiration and hope. And so thank you very much, Reverend Earl Smith, for joining our show today. I am Chris Weber. I want to thank you for tuning in to my podcast, Fearless or Insane. I'd like to thank my producer, E. I'd like to thank my other producer, David Rainier, who happens to be the other half of the Beat Brothers. And I'd like to send you home with a little song we did, a little beat we made. It's called Deep End. We'll see you next week.
Ain't always green, the stars don't shine as bright, and her instinct's always right. And her watch could buy a house, but her heart can't buy no love. It's cold under that blouse. Shades hide the back, she cries. Pills soothe her pain inside. A smile may wreak a gin. That dog's her only friend.
Stay tuned for 60-second AP News headlines.
Healthcare discussions. I'm Ed Donahue with an AP News Minute.
I want everyone to know I'm 100% behind this.
President Trump met with at the White House with Republican lawmakers about the GOP healthcare bill. He says the press has not been speaking properly about how great this bill is.
I watch. I say that's not the bill we're passing. And I also want everyone to know that all of these no's or potential no's are all yeses, every single person sitting in this room.
On Capitol Hill, Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price says they're hearing the Obama health care plan is not responding to people's needs.
They don't have the kind of access that they want. They don't have, they're not able to afford. We met this week at the White House with many individuals who felt they'd been harmed by Obamacare, by the ACA.
The president is meeting with German Chancellor Angela Merkel at the White House. The government says February recorded its second hottest temperature on record, behind only last year. I'm Ed Donahue.